Hi there, my name's Emily Sexton and you're listening to the Breakfast Club podcast. The American composer John Cage, famous for his avant-garde music compositions, is arguably one of the most influential figures in contemporary art. Perhaps his most famous work is 4:33, where a pianist sits at a piano for 4 minutes, 33 seconds and plays nothing. John Cage asks his audience to listen in a different way, to hear music where we would typically just hear noise. He makes the ordinary extraordinary. Where did this giant of the 20th century come from? What are the unique things about this person's upbringing that make him John Cage? This excerpt from his autobiographical statement gives us some small insight.
When I wish as now to tell of critical incidents, persons and events that have influenced my life and work, the true answer is all of the incidents were critical. All of the people influenced me. Everything that happened and that is still happening influences me. My father was an inventor. He told me that if someone says can't, that shows you what to do. My mother, she was never happy. When we would go for a Sunday drive, she'd always regret that she hadn't brought so-and-so with us. Sometimes she would leave the house and say she was never coming back. Dad was patient and always calmed my alarm by saying, "Don't worry, she'll be back in a little while." Neither of my parents went to college. When I did, I dropped out after 2 years. I was shocked to see 100 of my classmates in the library all reading copies of the same book. Instead of doing as they did, I went to the stacks and read the first book written by an author whose name began with Z. I received the highest grade in the class. That convinced me that the institution was not being run correctly. I left.
At 33, after both of his parents' deaths, Cage wrote two small character pieces, Dad for his father and Crete for his mother, the latter you can hear playing now. And that brings us to the theme of this week's podcast, Nature Over Nurture. How does your family shape your relationship with art? This podcast brings you the edited highlights and a little bit extra from Breakfast Club on Wednesday, the 19th of June. My name's Emily Sexton. I'm the Artistic Director of Next Wave, a contemporary art organisation based in Melbourne, Australia. So our first speaker is Fung No, and Fung is one of the artists that we're working with through our Kickstart program over 2013 to develop a new work that will debut in the 2014 festival in May. Fung's practice explores the individual and collective identity of the Vietnamese diaspora through the exploration of history, politics and culture. He completed an honours degree in fine art at RMIT in 2012 and he's exhibited at numerous galleries throughout Melbourne. His talk covered 100 years of family history. It's the story of a family fleeing from the Viet Minh, then fleeing from the Khmer Rouge right down to Adelaide. As Fung speaks, he refers to a series of photos taken from his family album. They are grey and green and worn. Each image has a makeshift formality. The people in them are serious, standing rigidly and waiting for the photo to be taken. At one point, he refers to a world map which has 5 red dots, one in Canada, one in the USA, one in Germany, one in Vietnam, and one in Australia. It's the spread of his family throughout the world.
This is my mum, the most wonderful woman in the world to me. I owe her everything. She's a woman who's been twice displaced by war, by ethnic cleansing, by economic circumstances, and she's raised what I hope are 4 okay children. This is my dad's family. This is the only photo they've got. Unlike my mum's family, they were poor. My dad is the little boy. That's my great-grandmother. That's my grandmother and my uncles and aunties. This photo was taken because my dad's older brother fell into a lake while going to the bathroom at night and drowned. And this photo is actually cropped up a few years ago and they discussed around a table and they realised that this photo was taken to commemorate the children that were still alive. And it's the single photo they've got of themselves as children. And after this, there were 4 more. My parents on their wedding day, they literally live across the river from each other. My dad stalked my mum for a while and she caved in. This photo is interesting that there is a picture of Uncle Ho in the background that my mum wants me to Photoshop out, but I refuse because it puts it in a place and time. And it's that photo is there because my grandmother was very paranoid. The Viet Cong took everything from them and they ended up dirt poor in the end. This is them in the refugee camp. Notice my mum is pregnant with my sister. Displaced again and pregnant again. So much like my grandmother, this is kind of a reoccurring theme. accepted into Australia in 1982. This is their visas. And so when I'm talking about the tyranny of distance, I know that it relates to Australia and an understanding of Australian culture and how we identify ourselves. But this is where my family is spread currently at this point in time. And my work is designed to reconnect all of these kind of dots and how I relate to them, the choices that have been made before me, the predetermined choices, have affected me as a person and therefore me as an artist. And this is key. This was said to me when I met an older Vietnamese woman and she asked me where I was from and I said, Adelaide. She said, no, where are you from? And then I said, Adelaide. She said, no, where are your parents from? I said, oh, this part. And then I explained to her that they were refugees, not me. I wasn't a boat person. I was born here. And she said, this is what she told me. She said, you were carried here in your parents' hearts. You are a boat person too. And that really struck a chord. It was only a few weeks ago that this was said to me. Kind of started welling up and had to leave. And this is the reason why my parents left. These are the four kids with chicken pox in 1990. And the idea is that the education that they could provide for us here was the key to everything. So my question to you is, what predetermined forces within your family define who you are as people, as artists, as parents? My niece was just born last year. She's the first in three generations to be born in the same country as her mother.
Fung's speech opened up a lot of discussion amongst the room about just how many of us can relate to the immigrant story, that the majority of people have travelled here. His honesty and his generosity meant for a very warm, open space where people were incredibly willing to share personal stories and experiences. Stephen Payton is a descendant of the Gunai people. He's an interdisciplinary artist who is also working with Next Wave to create a new work for the festival next year. His practice explores tradition, race, and colonialism, informed through his worldview as an Aboriginal Australian.
I went to a school that was pretty much, I was the only Aboriginal kid at that school, me and my brother, and that kind of was an interesting experience because it was an Anglican school and they're kind of pushing this Anglican agenda, and I kind of had to just not listen to some parts and take on what I wanted and learn from them what I wanted to learn from them. Because at the same time, I was being brought up by my family and being taught about my culture and about my people and traditions and all that sort of thing. So I was kind of in this duality of learning. My family were kind of involved in politics and cultural heritage and all this sort of stuff. And they're all artists as well. And they're all pretty well-recognised artists. They're held in state institutions and national institutions. And some of my role models growing up, my aunties and uncles and my nan and pop, they still are. I was always around them kind of watching and listening and learning. Still am learning about certain things and stories and culture. And I think it's a evolving thing. It's not stagnant. You don't just kind of download it. You're constantly getting it. But yeah, in saying that, one of the other things that I have noticed, being in Melbourne for the last sort of 5 years, I've had some freedom to be away from my family. My immediate family is kind of quite conservative, I think, and so they probably don't necessarily understand contemporary art or anything that's kind of different from traditional art. So I've kind of had this freedom to move away from the traditional sort of landscapes and doing designs and Aboriginal sort of traditional work, to kind of using that as a base and kind of going out and creating my own sort of style. So when I got asked to talk here, I got given a series of questions asking what in my childhood has impacted me. And I think my upbringing, as I said, in an all sort of all white Anglican school, you really do see the difference, especially in the country, and you really do learn about what people know and what people don't know about Aboriginal culture in Victoria. I guess that's kind of given me a lot of drive to educate people and try and teach people about where I'm coming from, and tell Aboriginal stories and traditional stories, and try and connect with people in a new sort of modern way. So I do like to tell traditional stories and knowledge in sort of in a modern context or different ways. As I see myself as more of an educator, I'd like to ask everyone in the room, put your hand up if you know whose traditional lands are on here today. Okay, that's pretty good. It's probably half the room. We're on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And who here knows how to say welcome? We've got three people in the room. It's Wamanjeka in the Woiwurrung language. And so my provocation to you guys is go and learn something about Aboriginal culture in Victoria, and go and seek it out, and just, you know, kind of take it in, because it's here and it's strong and it needs to be promoted and learnt about.
So Stephen's provocation resulted in a bunch of discussion about how we learn about Indigenous culture or don't. There was a discussion about the value of learning about Indigenous culture through immersion, so travel and conversation. There's one tweet that came out from Jetsetting Joyce, who's one of our live scribes, that said that appreciating Aboriginal art is a way to relate to social issues in those communities. There was other discussion around how children need to be exposed to Aboriginal art, and that taking them to galleries and making Aboriginal stories part of the curriculum would be a huge step forward. And there's, just a whole lot of discussion about the education system and how Indigenous culture is or isn't part of the curriculum. So our final speaker is Jo Case, and she is the Wheeler Centre's senior writer and editor. Her first book, Boomer and Me, A Memoir of Motherhood and Asperger's, is published by Hardy Grant in Australia and the UK.
Over a Christmas barbecue last year, my family started to tease me about my memoir, which at the time, it was published a few months ago, but at that time it had just been written and edited, and it was in the process of being proofread, so it was pretty much finished. My brother Nick asked me, "So when do we get to read this book? We're all in it, right?" And I said, "You know, you can read it whenever you want." I'd already, no one took me up on it. I'd already invited my mum and one of my sisters to read it, and they'd both said that they wanted to wait until it was a published book. "It will be more special that way," my mum said. And I told her, "You know, I can't change anything then if you don't like it. It'll be too late. It'll be printed." And she said, "Why would I want you to change it? What have you said about us?" And I told her that when I'm reading a book, I like characters who are flawed. If they're all good, they don't seem real to me. So while I'd be writing with affection about them, there would be moments of conflict, and I wasn't going to make them all good or one note. To which my mum said, and we changed the subject. I had hinted in the book, although I hadn't specifically said, that I think that my brother, the one who was teasing me, also has Asperger's syndrome, like my son. And that was a conversation my brother and I had just once before, and a part of that conversation is in the book. So when my brother brought up the book at that barbecue, I felt a little bit sick. And when he moved into joking about suing me if he didn't like what I said about him, and all of my siblings joined in, it was in great fun, but I didn't find it very fun at all. From then on, until publication, I worried pretty much constantly about how my family would react. So why write about them? Families fascinate me, including my own. Part of the project of my book is making a kind of sense of the family I was born into and the family that I've made, and thinking about how those families have been fractured and reassembled and basically how they work. The questions that drive my book include: what makes a family work? What's a normal family, a normal childhood, a normal person? Is there such a thing, and does that matter? Within that, there's another series of questions I ask myself. How do you be a good mother, daughter, sister, wife? What's important? What compromises do you make? What are the stakes if you get it wrong? Is there a right way to do things? And what are the consequences of mistakes? First of all, I was driven to tell that central story of my son's diagnosis with Asperger's syndrome and how that's affected my family and the way that we think about ourselves and our identity. With my son, I asked his permission before I embarked on the book. I consulted him along the way, I read him sections, and I altered some at his request. Then I took a step back from the project and allowed it to be separate from his life. I told him, it's not you, it's a character based on a version of who you used to be, which doesn't mean that I invented things. It's, I guess, that I shaped things and I made a conscious decision about stopping the book at a certain point before he became a teenager. Writing the book has influenced the way that our family sees ourselves, particularly my son and I, and the memories that we keep returning to. My husband told me that reading the book felt a bit repetitious to him because my son and I had been talking about the incidents in it over and over when I was writing. I kind of hadn't realised this until he said it, but it's true. My son still refers to lines in the book, including some I cut. They've kind of become a bit of a private joke and a private dialogue that we have with each other. My representation of our lives, of our lived experience, has become part of it and has influenced it. My brother Nick, the one who joked about suing me, rang me after he finished reading my book to thank me, especially for the connections that I drew between him and Asperger's syndrome, which was the thing that had worried me so much. Not only was he not offended by it, but he embraced it as the answer to a series of puzzles about his relationship with the world. That was a risk that paid off. My mum says that my next book should be fiction. Something like Jodi Picoult, preferably a bestseller. I think she would like me to write something that she would like to read. A book with no reflection on her at all, except for the reflected glory of success. She says that she found my book hard to read, but not so much, I think, for any details she felt betrayed by, so much as the act of my having written about our lives. And also I think that you can choose not to see things in life, you can choose to kind of let them pass you by, but when they're there on the page, you're forced to really look at them, and I think that was hard too. I admit I feel like I've dodged a bullet or a series of them, but the material that attracts me is still the dynamics of families. And when I think about writing fiction, that's the sort of thing I would like to explore. But do I dare? My question is, what responsibility do we have to our families when we use them in our art? And how do we balance that with our responsibility as artists? What kind of risks are worth taking?
So from the refugee experience to growing up as an Aboriginal Australian to living with Asperger's, as usual, Breakfast Club elicits a whole range of responses to our central theme, which for this week is how your family shaped your relationship with art. Our next part of this podcast is overtime, and this is where we get the speakers together and just get them to sort of unwind from all that those big ideas and share with us what their reflections are. This conversation starts with talking about the artist's role as an educator. We then move to the artist as a representative of social issues, and we have a bit of a discussion about what an audience response is to both. What do you guys think is the role of art in an educative kind of knowledge-building context? Do you see yourself as educators? I mean, that's how you described yourself in the speech, Stephen. What about you guys?
I see myself as an educator, but through storytelling, if that makes sense. Mm. I enjoy telling stories, and that then touches on issues around migration and history of politics and displacement and economics. And, I mean, going back to kind of Indigenous education, it's kind of how do we address the issue where when I was at school, my Indigenous education was making a dot painting.
Yeah, it's pretty rudimentary as an educative approach.
How do you address those issues? Yeah. We could do it through art, but if it's as reductive as making it a dot painting, then it's probably doing more damage than it is doing any good.
Mm. What about you, Jo?
I think for me, it's about opening up a conversation, and because my book is about Asperger's syndrome, first and foremost, that's something that when my son was diagnosed with Asperger's, I went looking for books about it and for personal stories that I might connect with, and I found some things that spoke to aspects of my experience, but not really what I was looking for. And I know from talking to other people that others in my situation, often that's exactly what they do. It's not just because I'm hugely bookish that I really wanted to find a book with personal stories. And I've had so many great conversations with other people in my situation since I published the book. And I think it's around partly raising awareness, which I guess is kind of... I've never thought of it as education, but that sort of is. I wanted to write about... there's a lot of cliches around Asperger's out in the community. A lot of people don't know that much about it. And I really wanted to write about it as something that was an element of life rather than something that defined our lives.
Yeah, I'm interested because to be an educator as an artist is a very instrumental way at looking at an artistic practice. It's very practical, it's very outcomes focused in a way. And to use the art solely as a way to sort of problem solve things, I think everyone would agree is quite reductive. But at the same time, we do want that educative role. So how do you guys resolve those two different agendas, Stephen?
I guess for me, like in my practice, I like to blend, like I was saying, blend modern and traditional and towing that line of the educator and teaching people is kind of the background of the traditional stuff, and then bringing that modern aspect is myself in expressing myself and the way that I want to do it in kind of this day and age and my age and kind of what's happening at the moment. So it's kind of, I'm just kind of blending and distilling everything into this one thing.
Fung, you've been talking a lot to your family in the development of your Next Wave project. How do you go explaining to them, I would like to talk to you about, you know, our personal history, and then I'm going to make it into a public installation, and I'm going, you know, and you're going to do some pretty edgy things as well with that. What have their reactions been?
They don't get it. to put it short, they don't really get it. Well, that's probably a lie. That's probably making them sound a bit simple, but they understand what I'm going to do, and I think they're just starting to grasp why I want to do it. But for me, it's always been this fight of trying to not to make kind of a caricature of their experience, which is something that's always in the back of my mind. I'm drawing upon all their experiences as refugees and the wider Vietnamese community as well.
Do you guys feel like, you know, each of you, like Stephen representing, you know, Indigenous artists, you representing Asperger's, you representing the refugee experience, like these are huge, complex, diverse things. Does that get pressured? You know, do you feel uncomfortable with that at any time?
I guess I feel a personal responsibility to be able to tell this story. As a second-generation Vietnamese, I think it's important to reference that history and commenting on contemporary politics. And I think that I'm and my generation is at a privileged position to do so. And I do feel responsible to tell the story and not to be kind of a pure representation of the story itself, but a component of it. There's so much bad art out there about refugees that's polarizing, and that's probably the driving force behind why I make the work I make, why it's not confrontational, because I don't think that a confrontation in regards to a refugee debate is always the best way, or is the best way. I don't think it's a good way at all to enter into this debate. I think we need to focus on the human elements and the personal experiences and stories in discussing the politics behind refugees. And when we look at the human aspects of it, and it is a human experience, it is a personal experience, and we draw upon that rather than drawing upon what a politician says.
What Fong's saying about kind of not having that conflict and not being kind of political with, or overly political with what you're saying, and making it more personalised and it's a personal experience. I think I find it hard in Australia, because people have an idea about how, especially with Aboriginal Australia, how you should be, and they want to tell you kind of, you know, their idea of what an Aboriginal person is, how you should be, as well as your community is kind of telling you how to be, and you're just a person who wants to be themselves. Even now in that talk, we had some guy who was saying, what about the welcome to country? Why didn't Stephen do a welcome to country? And
Why
didn't you do it? You know, but like that's a ceremony that's kind of been adopted from Aboriginal cultures, and you know, people have this idea about it. Politicians are taking it on. It's kind of taking away from the ceremony a little bit.
It's become a very politicised thing. I work for the federal government. Every single time there's something, there's a welcome to country. But it then reduces it to a political move.
Yeah. It's a procedure.
To the point where now our signature blocks, they're recommending our signature blocks leaving
your work.
The department have kind of Indigenous language and an acknowledgement of the land that there's the emails going around in, and it is very reductive. It's reducing
something. It's good. It's good.
It is good. It's kind of teaching people in a way. I think there is kind of room to make the power with those communities and not with the politicians and, you know, all these other people who are kind of adopting this ceremony. The ceremony belongs to the people whose land it is. And, you know, like, actually, it's not my place to welcome people to this land, because it's Wurundjeri land. So, you know, it's not really my place to do that. We do need to kind of have a conversation about how people are and how people are being in Melbourne, and respecting what's here and respecting cultures.
So that's it for this week. Thank you to the Wheeler Centre for hosting our Breakfast Club series. Next week, we will be talking feminism. The theme is a karma debate. Is that what feminism needs? On Wednesday, the 26th of June, 8 a.m, you can come to our live event at the Wheeler Centre, or you can just listen to this podcast. You can find out more information about Next Wave on our website. It's nextwave.org.au. My name's Emily Sexton, and thanks for listening.